call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order. Welcome, committee. Welcome, people in the audience, of which we have very few today. We are going to start with public hearing. Well, actually, I think we'll just do the work session first. I'm going to open a work session for possible bill introduction, but before we get to that, I have a motion that the rules be suspended and the vote by which LC draft 1973 was introduced as a committee bill be reconsidered. I guess I'm supposed to repeat that. I think I was supposed to give this to Senator Morris. I have moved that the rules be suspended and the vote by which LC draft 1973 was introduced as a committee bill be reconsidered. Is there any discussion of this committee? Just so you know, one of the bills we introduced as a committee bill last week was not ready to be introduced, and I messed up and let it get on the agenda. So we're pulling it back, and a very similar bill will be coming probably in a week. So is there any objection? So ordered. Thank you. So it just comes back to our committee now, right? Yeah. All right, now the bill is back before the committee in its original form, and if the committee has the amendments from LC, the amendments may be. Okay. All right.
Well, we have it back before the committee, and so you don't need to take further action.
Okay, cool. Let it rest in peace. Okay, now we have a bill draft to be considered. Mr. Warner.
Yes, Madam Chair. You have LC 2471. And again, I'll remind you that today is Groundhog's Day, and so 5 o'clock today is the last time, is the deadline for getting bill draft requests in. The LC 2471 is would be a committee bill. What it does is essentially removes the requirement that 70% of revenues from new transit lodging tax be used to fund tourism or tourism-related facilities. This is at the based on work done in the interim to increase flexibility for local governments, and that's basically what the bill does.
Okay, and then, committee, I remind you that bill introductions are just that. They do not imply or infer that we take a position. So, Senator Morris, do you have a motion?
Madam Chair, I move the adoption of LC 2471 as a committee bill.
Senator Morris has moved that LC 2471 be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Okay, now it's public hearing time, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 82. I guess you're the expert on this, since it has to do with some sort of vice. Is that correct, Manson?
That is correct, Madam Chair. This is the lottery. A lottery bill, and I have an SMS staff measure summary in your packet to introduce you to the bill. This changes the requirement from the lottery in filing biennial reports to doing it annually. Of course, as you know, the lottery does not go through the same process of budgeting as the other state agencies, but these were thought of as reports to follow along with the same process. However, the lottery would want to go with the annual budget, since that's the way they do business, and file those annual reports. The other issue that this bill deals with is the repeal of ORS 461548. And in your summary, I've included what this ORS is. And what it does basically is ask the lottery to account for the costs of the video and the traditional lottery proceeds separately, in order to be able to adjust or account for the collection costs or administrative costs for the two different ones. And with the discussion earlier with Larry from the lottery, this has been a subject of issues with the AG opinion, Attorney General. This is in your packet, Madam Chair, about how these discussions with the Attorney General about whether these are required under the constitutional requirement or not. And the issue that they don't seems to be that these might be a little more restrictive than the Constitution. However, that we were not able to conclude whether the requirements or the intent of the legislature when they put the statutes in place is already in somewhere else before the repeal of this statute. So this is what you have in front of you.
Thank you. Mr. Nicewender.
Yes, Chair Burdick and committee members, for the record, Larry Nicewender, Deputy Director, Oregon Lottery. I am here to just briefly speak to this bill, which we consider pretty much a housekeeping bill. Your staff has correctly summarized that there are two actual changes to this. One would be the submission of annual budget reports in the form and format as approved by the legislative fiscal officer versus a biennial budget report. And this is really premised upon the lottery's annual budget process and annual reporting process, so we're already providing a report on an annual basis. That particular change is a change that lottery has worked with the governor's office, the legislative fiscal officer, legislative revenue office, and the Department of Administrative Services Budget and Management Office during the interim to try and come up with a language that was workable for all concerned. So we believe it is, reflects that, and we wanted to make those changes accordingly. It was originally constructed at the time the lottery was established in 1985. There were a lot of unknowns about how lottery would be constructed and operate, and this really makes the statute conform to operating practice and reporting practice before each of those bodies. So the second aspect is the one-liner at the end of the bill, which is to repeal 461-548, which is staff has pointed out, in the Attorney General's opinion, it's been found to be more stringent than the actual constitutional provisions. So, as staff pointed out, it has to do with how the lottery accounts for its administrative expenses. It is constitutionally charged not to spend any more than 16% toward administrative expenses, and that is for all lottery games, whether they're video, traditional, or otherwise. And so it states that in the Constitution, and it actually states that in Section 461, 510, Section 4, exactly. Pretty much parrots back the constitutional provisions when it states, and that's not in your packet, by the way, but it is 461, 510, subsection 4, and I'll read it for you. It says, no more than 16% of the total annual revenues accruing to the from the sale of all lottery tickets and shares from all lottery games shall be allocated for the payment of expenses of the state lottery. So it doesn't draw a distinction between video lottery or traditional games. Now, we do separately account for them, but it doesn't actually say only up to 16% for video lottery and only up to 16% for traditional lottery separately. It's an overall.
Okay, so, but it does, this overall aggregate percentage does include the commissions that are paid to.
Correct.
And when you do break those out, what is the percentage?
Commissions over all games, about 1.92% over this last biennium.
What about video poker and line games?
Video, I believe, I can get that really quick. It's like 1.62% when you put, we're 1.7%. It's still a very small part of our total annual sales revenue.
Okay, that's measured against the 16%. So
correct, it's in there.
You have a 16% ceiling.
Correct.
And you're saying that that you're only getting up to 1.9%?
For the commissions piece, the sales commissions for retailers, I thought that was the piece you were referencing.
No, I mean, for video games, the overall administrative cost, that's what I'm after, which includes the commissions that is not Yeah, I mean, obviously not exclusively.
Yeah. I might have to defer to your staff on that. I know you had some slides in the orientation. I didn't bring that with me today. Overall, our administrative expenses are less than, I want to say safely, less than 4% as an, across all lines. Do you remember, Mazen?
Madam Chair, it's about, the total is about 3.5% now. Whether that is inclusive of the all the retailers' commissions, that's what you're...
That's correct. That's what I'm trying to get a fix on.
It is. Hmm.
So basically, you're somewhere between 3.5% and 4% for your overall administrative percentage, and you could go all the way up to 16%?
Correct.
Oh, okay. Good work. Okay. Do you have anything else to add?
No, just that we know there is no fiscal impact related to this bill. There is no known opposition to the bill, and we're not aware of any necessary changes for its passage.
Okay. All right. Any questions from the committee?
So I think Senator Telford was before me.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Senator Telford.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Rosenbaum. The question I have then is the purpose of this repealing this the purpose to make it less cumbersome to do the allocation of shared and indirect expenses? I mean, I'm not sure.
Yeah. In practice, it's actually no change. It's just that the statute was found to be more stringent than the Constitution, and it actually, I think if you read a fine reading of 548 versus 510, they actually conflict. 548 it reads that we have to separately account for administrative expenses for video and all other games and in other sections of the law. It doesn't require that, and it doesn't require it under the Constitution. So it's not really changing anything in practice.
Follow-up,
please.
So the requirement to separate those administrative expenses, there wasn't a purpose behind that verbiage to begin with? I guess my question is, was there a purpose to put that extra stringent piece into that law? Was there a purpose behind that?
Not that I'm aware of.
Madam Chair, Senator.
Madison.
I think there was obviously a legislative intent behind to look into these differently. However, that it seems to have gone probably more stringent than the Constitution would have required. Now, is there another language that might maintain that intent? There could be. However, that is not taken into this bill.
If I could add to that, Chair, in the legal opinion before you, which was a three-part question before them, the second part of that question was, is lottery required to account separately for the costs and revenue from video lottery games? And the answer was yes, and we will continue to do that. Give this committee and any committee the visibility into what those costs are. But it's in terms of as it accounts toward the 16% allowable percentage in the Constitution, it's overall games.
Okay.
And I will say probably at the beginning of this statute when it was formed, video lottery wasn't actually a part of the lottery's game offerings. It now accounts for approximately 97% of our revenue.
The video?
97.
That's pretty amazing. Yeah, given that percentage, I think I'd like to look into this a little bit more. Are there any other questions from the committee? Senator Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I essentially had the same question as Senator Telfer about whether it changed anything. As a practical matter, it sounds like it doesn't. But it is curious that we seem to have had language that's been unconstitutional since 1992, and now we're just realizing it.
And I can't actually speak to the timing of this change, but we had other reasons for wanting to come in here and make this section of the law conform to practice and Constitution, and this seemed like a good opportunity to put them two in one bill.
Okay. All right. Well, I think I want to look at the constitutional piece again, because it's, you know, this says it's unconstitutional, but I want to, you know, there's a difference between not being required by the Constitution and being prohibited by the Constitution. So I'd like to get a little more clarity on that. Any other questions? Okay, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 82 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 183. And we will change experts, staff, economists again. Okay, Dave, what do we have on this?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. We have Senate Bill 183. When revised in 2007, ORS 308-146, 8A states that when a building is demolished or removed from property, the maximum assessed value of the property may be reduced to reflect the demolishment or removal of the building. However, it fails to spell out the ordering of adjustments when more than one adjustment to the maximum assessed value is needed. So what this bill does is it specifies, first, timeline for filing application for reduction of MAV, maximum assessed value, of demolished or removed property. And second, it specifies the order of adjustment when more than one adjustment to MAV or of demolished or removed property is needed. And finally, it clarifies the appeal process of maximum assessed value adjustments to demolished or removed property. On the last point, actually, the appeal is suggested that the appeal can be made to local tax property board or tax court. So then what this bill does is it clarifies the appeal process, and appeal can be made to local property tax board.
Okay, so instead of going directly to tax court, are you saying that?
Well, actually, Madam Chair, it was suggested that in one section it says there are actually two venues specified. One was to local property tax board, or and the other one was tax court. So this what this bill does, and John Phillips can fill in a little. What this bill does is the appeal can be headed to just directly to local tax.
Okay, and then maybe John, come on up. Let me just ask the question, then you can identify yourself and answer it. This, I presume, would set up a process where you initially appeal it to the local board, and then you could move on to the tax court. Is that understanding correct?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, John Phillips of the Oregon Department of Revenue. That's correct.
Okay. So the first one, I presume it was just a lack of clarity that made it seem like you could go either place directly?
Yes, Madam Chair, and it was the location where it was placed in the statute that caused some of this confusion, and so this bill actually moves it to another section of the statute.
Okay. And it's my recollection we just did this bill last year, isn't that correct, last session?
Madam Chair, yes, it was Senate Bill 697 from last session that actually changed the policy, and this bill facilitates the implementation of that policy that Senator Morris was working on last session.
Okay.
I'd like to get those two bills, concepts, the policy and administration all in one bill, sometimes it doesn't work that way, so
that's
here we
right.
are.
We find that a lot in revenue, just because we're dealing with such simple stuff. Is there any opposition or concern at the local level that you know of to this bill?
No opposition that I'm aware of. Some of the assessors, I will tell you that a couple of the county assessors have talked to me and said that they don't see a need for an application. But I explained to them that, you know, they need to bring that forward, and the association hasn't made a decision on it, and I can't speak for them. The department has no position whatsoever on the application. It's not our concern. We just want to be sure it operates correctly. And so in our bill, we took the application process that was in the statute from last session's bill, and we just moved it to another section where it works, we think, a little better. And so, like I said, we're not opposed to that. I think they might, if they, as an association, get together and decide that's what they want to do, they'll bring forward maybe an amendment when they get organized.
Okay. Well, we won't hold it up because of that reason alone. Are there questions from the committee of either Day or Mr. Phillips? Okay. Thank you. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 183 and open a work session. What did I say? I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 183. I'm ahead of myself. And open a work session on Senate Bill 183. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move Senate Bill 183 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Morris has moved Senate Bill 183 to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. I think we'll have our local government expert carry this bill, Senator Telfer. Okay, now close the work session that we had going on here, and we will open an informational meeting on the corporate income tax that was carried over from our last meeting. You're on, Chris. We got a big problem.
Spring is here.
We're trying to do something different with the PowerPoint.
Help. He's competing with Mez and Sam.
Are they saying there's holes in the corporate tax?
Gaps?
There are holes in this tax bill.
We really do have a tax gap in this state, that's for sure.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Chris Allenite, Legislative Revenue Office. And what we have here is an overview of the corporate income and excise taxes. And I have about an hour of slides here. I'll try to get through relatively at a decent pace because the discussions of the corporate tax have the dual impact of inflicting pain and drowsiness on people at various times throughout the day.
And we're not even the ones who pay them.
Oh, I don't know about that.
Some of us. Corporate.
Okay, kind of the outline for the discussion I have here is common terms or just a few concepts that I want to run through related to the corporate tax. Then I want to focus a little bit on apportionment. I have a handful of slides to get at the issue of apportionment, which is a significant issue. And then I have a few slides on tax liability, tax credits, which are often a big issue with corporations, and then some tax collections. And again, I break it down between the tax liability and tax collections because all of the determining the tax liability is kind of the tax return perspective, and then the collections is what's important for budgetary purposes in terms of forecasting and understanding what dollars come in the door at what time. So to start off with, the corporate taxation, we actually have two taxes. There's an excise tax and an income tax, and the vast majority of C corporation filers pay the excise tax. There are only a couple hundred corporations that pay the income tax. And the excise tax was established in 1929 and was used as a partial replacement for the state property tax at the time. It was established as an excise tax because at the time there was a federal prohibition on taxing income from federal securities. And so the way the Oregon legislature got around that was by establishing an excise tax as opposed to an income tax, and it was an excise tax based on the for the privilege of doing business in the state. And so it is measured on income, and often people just refer to the corporate income tax, but just technically it is the excise tax. And the income tax was established in 1955 for corporations not doing business in income, but for those having income from Oregon sources.
Senator Hess.
Did you mean to say business not doing business in Oregon? Corporations not doing business in Oregon.
Right, okay. So that's the technical phrase then. Corporate income tax is paid by out of state based corporations and the excise tax.
Senator Hess, the out of state corporations will pay both of them. I mean, it depends on what activities they do. Roughly speaking, there are 33,000 C corporations that file tax returns. Only 200 of them or so file an income tax return. The distinction is a multi-state corporation, if it is doing business in Oregon, it files the excise tax. That's the...
Okay.
And if they're not doing business in Oregon, but they do have income from an Oregon source, say they own some rental property in Oregon, but that's not connected to their business, then Oregon has nexus to tax that income, so they would file a tax return and pay income tax on that.
Okay, so anybody who makes money for their C corporation in Oregon would pay an excise tax.
Yes, if they're doing business. Generally what you think of, and any of the corporations you see doing in the state will pay the excise tax.
Okay, so if they're out of state and they pay the income tax, do they get the 6.6% rate? So even if they have an activity that's similar to an individual taxpayer activity, because they're a corporation, they get a lower tax rate? You gave the example of rental income.
If they're a C corporation, right.
Were you aware of that, Senator Morris?
No. But I'm not a CPA either.
Were you aware of that?
But if I may explain that a little bit, there's a graduated tax rate for individuals also. Not everybody pays 9%. And so corporations at 6.6, it's not graduated, it's 6.6. The other thing is that there are a lot of, where was I going with that? That's some of the explanation. The 6.6 sounds like it's low, but not necessarily. Also, federal corporate tax rates, there's many situations where the corporations pay more than an individual or vice versa, and so there's lots of fun planning you can do with all these things. But to say 6.6, that's the flat rate. It's not necessarily graduated like it is with the income in individual tax.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay, the issue of nexus is one that... and it's fair to say is far from settled, but it's the notion of which corporations the state can tax. And nexus is a connection, it's a tie between a corporation and the state. And so basically, if a corporation has nexus in the state, then Oregon has the right to tax it. And if they don't have nexus, then Oregon cannot tax it. And
does that apply to both forms of tax, the income tax and the excise tax?
Well, the nexus, it'll generally be the excise tax because it has to do with
right.
doing business.
So, okay. So if an out-of-state corporation has income from Oregon but does not pays the income tax but not the excise tax, do they have nexus?
Probably not, because in that case they would not be doing business in Oregon.
Okay, so nexus means actually doing business here rather than just getting income from here.
It's some sort of tie, connection to the state.
But connection could be...
It's doing... It's that notion of doing business, which is... I should probably just leave it at that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does, except, it depends on how you define tie or doing business, because if the example you used, if you have a C corporation that's out of state, but they get rental income from property they own in Oregon, then is that a nexus?
I think it's fair to say that the issue of nexus there, it's a complicated issue, and in fact, the Department of Revenue has a unit devoted to looking at nexus issues for corporations.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a lot of case law. I have a couple of bullet points underneath this getting at the issue of nexus.
Okay, well, let's let you continue and see if we can...
Okay. The first one is this Federal Public Law 86-272, which was passed in 1959. And this actually, it put some parameters on the state taxation of multi-state corporations. It prohibits the taxation of corporations whose only connection to the state is the solicitation of tangible property in the state. So you have a corporation, they're not located in the state, their only connection to the state is soliciting sales of tangible property. This law says that the state cannot tax those corporations. The key thing, one of the key things about that is that it's limited to sales of tangible personal property. So it doesn't apply to the financial sector for intangibles. The next thing is physical presence, and this gets at one of the debate points over the years about what constitutes nexus. So if you have a corporation that has a physical presence in the state, they have sales offices here, they have a manufacturing plant here, they're clearly in the state, and then they have nexus, and then the state has the right to tax them. It gets a little more nebulous if the state doesn't have physical presence in the state. Is there a sufficient tie between a given corporation and the state so that the state can impose the excise tax? And a lot of this has to do with the intangible sector, the financial sector, because of Public Law 86-272. If the only connection is the solicitation of sales, then the federal law prohibits that. And so there have been a number of court cases over the years dealing with whether or not physical presence is required for nexus and what kind of bright line requirement there is to clarify the issue of nexus.
Well, and you say that financial, it doesn't cover financial institutions, but what if you have a Bank of America branch, I mean, in the state? Would that be nexus?
If there's a branch there and they have a physical location, then in that case, if there's physical presence, I think it's fair to say that it's clear that there's nexus. Mm-hmm. The issue is if there's not physical presence, it becomes a little less clear as to whether or not nexus exists.
So this is an issue with credit cards, right?
And I'm getting to a key point with that, with the notion of economic nexus. And over the past couple of years, there have been various court cases in other states pertaining to the issue of economic nexus and whether or not that is sufficient grounds for establishing nexus. And one of the notable cases here was in West Virginia. It was MBNA. It was a credit card company that was headquartered in Delaware, and their only connection to West Virginia was credit cards that they would sell to West Virginians. And in, I believe it was 98 and 99, they had gross receipts of $8 or $10 million, and the state of West Virginia imposed their income tax on the state, on the MBNA. MBNA remitted the tax, but then they filed suit to get it back, saying that they didn't have nexus in the state because they had no physical presence in the state. The long and short of it is that the West Virginia Supreme Court argued on the grounds, on largely on the grounds of economic nexus, that there was a sufficient tie between this credit card company and the state of West Virginia. Basically, the company was reaping benefit from the economy of West Virginia, and so they ruled that that was sufficient for an economic nexus, and that West Virginia did have the right to impose the tax. It got appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. They denied to hear it. They denied hearing it in 2007. And so these kinds of cases have been cropping up in other states and trying to flush out really the clarity of nexus.
And so that's the law of the land in West Virginia, but not other states unless the Supreme Court rules.
Well, not necessarily. Oregon follows the economic nexus principle. It's a matter of interpretation of existing statute. And there are those who would argue that Oregon statutes have always allowed economic nexus to be the sufficient grounds for establishing corporate nexus. And as these cases have come out in other states, as you get a body of, you have statute and you have interpretation of statute, and that's always up for debate. And it's not until a court starts hearing some of these cases that you get the judicial branch weighing in on the subject. So over the past couple of years, we've had various state-level judicial branches weighing in on the subject of economic nexus. And I'm certainly not a lawyer, but a lot of the argument has to do with the changing economy and how things are different over the past 100 years or so.
To your knowledge, have any of the courts ruled against the states on establishing nexus?
I don't know offhand. I couldn't cite any, but I believe there. I believe taking the entire court system in the U.S., I believe there are mixed, possibly. But I can talk to Ledge Counsel and get back to you on some sort of list of those that have landed on either side.
Okay, yeah, that would be worth doing because I think this issue came up last session. I think it will probably we probably haven't seen the end of it.
I think that's fair to say, and I don't know that there are cases that are definitive one way or the other. For example, even in issues of physical presence, there was an earlier court case that ruled that physical presence was required, but the case pertained to sales and use taxes. So on the one hand, okay, physical presence, you have a court saying physical presence is required for nexus, but it's with respect to the use tax. So then the question is, okay, well, how does that apply to the income tax? And so these are the issues that go before the courts. And this is kind of a current state, this notion of economic nexus. And really, the whole point of nexus is a tie between a corporation and a state, and to the extent that tie grants taxing authority. Unitary group, this is simply when a corporation has various affiliates at the federal level, they are required to file a consolidated return, and Oregon follows suit there. So if a consolidated return is required at the federal level, in Oregon, they have to file the same consolidated return. So you'll have one return might represent many different businesses.
Okay, regardless of whether they all do business in the state?
If they're filed as a unitary group at the federal level, meaning they can be viewed as one business, there certain criteria might exist. There might be a centralization of management or administrative services. There might be some vertical integration, but if they can be viewed as a unitary group at the federal level, then they file a consolidated return at the federal level. And if they do that in Oregon, they need to file a consolidated return. But this is an area where there can be some tax planning going on if a given corporation is in or out of that unitary group. And it does get pretty complicated.
Senator Hess?
Wasn't this the tax that Vicatia famously eliminated or modified back in the 80s as a bone to get some Japanese companies to invest in building plants in Oregon?
Senator House, I'm not sure. That's a little bit more for my time.
I'll have to. The unitary tax. That was,
I don't know if Paul recalls.
Paul, you would know that.
The decision in 86 was to limit what would be included in income at Water's Edge. So there could not be, you could not have the total base based on worldwide income.
So, oh, worldwide.
Right. So what happened was the law that passed at that time limited it to Water's Edge or nationally, and then is what you apportion from as your base.
By Water's Edge, you mean nationally, not just
yes.
in the state?
Right. Well, yeah. No. What you're doing when you're and Chris will get to the apportionment next, but what you apportion from would be the national profits rather than global profits. So it narrowed it to national, and then the apportionment formula takes it to the state level based on the sales factor now or whatever factors.
Okay.
And the notion of apportionment and allocation, the profits or the income that a business has, that a corporation has, again, we're talking about multi-state corporations. If a corporation exists solely within Oregon, all of its income will be taxed by Oregon. So for the multi-state corporations, there will be income that is apportioned to the various states where they do business and income that will be allocated to individual states. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. The apportionment, and this is where the sales factor comes in, and The Uniform Division of Income for Tax Purposes Act was an attempt to get all the states on the same page with respect to apportionment. As corporation income tax developed over the years, you had a mishmash of states taxing different portions of a corporation's income. So a corporation could be paying tax on less than or more than 100% of its income, depending on how the various states determined how much of a corporation's income that they could tax. So the upshot of that was the equally weighted formula where you had the sales factor, the payroll factor, and the property factor. And the theory there is that if all states use the same equally weighted three-factor formula, then you have a 100% apportioning of corporation income. over time, that has we've gone away from that a little bit, and I have a couple. I'll talk about that a little bit more later. The notion of allocation really gets at the distinction between business income and non-business income. Business income, the income from that corporation's reason for being in business, gets apportioned to where it's earned. Non-business income gets allocated to the state of domicile. So if a corporation has capital gains income, it gets allocated to their state of domicile. It does not get apportioned. And that's also another issue with respect to compliance and enforcing the tax, is whether or not a given income is considered business income or non-business income for a corporation. So just at a very high level here, this is kind of the federal perspective of determining taxable income. So you have a corporation, they make their sales, they have the gross receipts, less their cost of goods sold equals their gross profit, plus other sources of income, any dividends, interest, or rents that they have gets at their total income, and then subtracting their deductions, all of their cost of doing business, payroll, interest, rent, and depreciation, results in federal taxable income. And right now, this is a hot topic in the state. This federal taxable income is what Oregon currently, as of today anyway, ties to federal taxable income. This is the starting point for Oregon taxation. So this is the Oregon, corresponding Oregon flowchart. So we start with federal taxable income. We make some Oregon adjustments to get at an Oregon taxable income before apportionment. Apportionment gets applied, the Oregon net loss deductions are subtracted, and then you arrive at Oregon taxable income. And then this income is applied to the 6.6% rate, and then that equals Oregon tax before credits.
So what's the net loss deduction?
Those would be operating losses from prior years. So if a corporation has a loss in a given year, they can carry that loss forward and offset that loss against future gains.
Don't they do that on the? Isn't that factored into the federal taxable income, or are these just Oregon losses?
The feds do it too. We tie to the point before that federal loss deduction is taken into consideration.
Oh, okay. So we do our own version of that.
Yeah, we have our own version.
Right.
Okay, looking a little bit at multi-state apportionment, currently 46 states have some form of a corporate income tax, and only 9 of them currently use the equally weighted formula. 12 of them use the double weighted formula, and 4 use a super sales factor somewhere between 50% and 90%, and then 10% use a 100% sales factor. And then 11 use some sort of hybrid system. That might be they could have 100% sales factor for the manufacturing industry and equally weighted for other sectors or some other kind of version. So currently it's all over the map in terms of how states are applying apportionment percentages. There has been a trend to move toward 100% sales. Oregon's apportionment formula, historically, for tax years up through 1990, wasn't the equally weighted formula. I mean, that's one-third for each of sales, payroll, and property. And then from 91 to 03, it was a double-weighted sales factor. So in terms of and then in 03 to 05, it was 80%. And then since July 1, 2005, we have a 100% sales factor. Again, it does only apply to multi-state corporations, and for all of the corporations, both C and S, so there are 33,000 C corporations and 55,000 S corporations, 22% of them are affected by apportionment. So that's 12,000 C corporations and 7,000 S corporations that are affected by apportionment.
So there are winners and losers. Who are some of the winners and who are some of the losers as we went to the single sales?
Generally speaking, the single sales factor winners were those manufacturing sector who had a lot of property and payroll in the state and few sales. Generally speaking, of those affected by apportionment, there were two-thirds of them were losers and one-third of them were winners in terms of on an individual basis. But on a net basis, it was a revenue loss. because the losers lost more than the winners.
No, the losers gained.
Did I say that right? Did I say it backwards?
The losers
gain more.
Yes. No, the winners won more in terms of reduced revenue than the losers lost from paying more revenue.
Yes. Yes. Okay.
Kat, do you know, maybe Paul, this might be for you too, this is what the policy reason is for these exceptions?
Senator, you know, I can speak to the move from the double-weighted to what eventually became the 100% sales factor. They were made on a largely individual basis. We do have one that was actually made largely for an individual company whose circumstances have since changed. And we actually have no one taking that one. And we've actually requested a bill draft for that to be eliminated with no revenue impact. The other one was in terms of allowing a choice for telecoms, and the decision was made that this was an exception because of, you know, the fact that there was a fair amount of property in the state, but also a fair amount of sales, and it was just made on an individual basis and basically on an equity grounds. And I think that's the evaluation you see in the tax expenditure report, is it was made on an equity fairness basis by the committee. But those are the only two exceptions we have, is the telecom treatment and then the individual company. That's the two that are in the statutes.
And the individual company would have been that wood products company?
That's correct, Madam Chair. Okay.
So if we repeal that part, that cleans that part up. There are no other wood products.
At this time, we don't have. We have a zero impact on actually using that exception. So we don't earn any. Shouldn't affect anyone. There's been a change in the ownership of that company, and that's changed their status in terms of the impact. But on the telecom, you do have a distinction there, because you do have some companies, and then if you look on the tax expenditure report, it's actually evaluated by the Public Utility Commission. You do have companies that are regulated by the PUC, in which case their corporate income taxes would affect rate decisions because they're built into the rates. And then you also have companies that used to be regulated that are no longer regulated, in which you have a different consideration. It's just a matter of tax policy without, you know, any regulation of the price.
But the tax expenditure report meshes them all together. Do we have any way of breaking out the ones that are non-regulated?
Madam Chair, we could take a look at that and try to make a finer distinction on that, and I'd be happy to get some back to the committee.
Good. That would be good. Thank you. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chris, you made a reference to some numbers, and I wasn't quite tracking. I think you were referring to the total number of C-Corps registered in the state, and that number was...
Senator Morris, for 2006, it was roughly 33,100.
33,000?
That filed a corporation.
And the S-Corps?
Just under 55,000.
55,000. Then I'm not following the roughly 12,300 C-Corps.
Those are multi-state.
22%.
That's 22%.
The 22. So the 33,000 plus the 55,000. So you have 88,000 returns. 22% of all of those corporations are affected by apportionment.
Okay, I follow your math.
Because
now.
They're multi-state, and the other ones, I presume, are all in-state corporations.
Correct.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any questions?
No, I'm just thinking.
Okay. Senator Rosenbaum is thinking, let the record show. Okay, go ahead, Chris.
Okay, here's an example of the apportionment. So we have a company that is operating in Oregon and California, and they have payroll of $40 million, property of $50 million, sales of $80 million. And so their factors play out this way, so that their apportionment in Oregon is 25%. That's their sales factor. So we have a single sales factor for Oregon, because 30% of their payroll is in Oregon, 70% in California. For their property, 40% of their property is in Oregon, and 60% of their property is in California. 25% of their sales are in Oregon, and 75% in California. So their apportionment factors for the two states, in Oregon it's 25%, again, just the sales factor. And in California, it's a double-weighted sales factor. So averaging these together, counting sales twice, results in an apportionment factor of 70.
Hmm.
So in this particular case, the total of those is only 95%. So if their net income is $5 million, in Oregon, the $5 million times the 25% means Oregon can tax $1.25 million of their net income. And California would tax 70% of that $5 million, or the $3.5 million. And then in Oregon, the $1.25 million times the 6.6% means a pre-credit liability of $82,500.
So the tell me how this double sales factor, I'm not seeing how that...
The double sales factor is an average of the payroll, property, and the sales counted twice. So it's the average of 70, 60, 75, and 75. That's how the double-weighted sales works.
And then they divide that by four?
Four. And they divide that by four.
Oh, I see.
So then the apportionment factor is 70%.
And what is the effect on the business climate when you do that? I mean, obviously, the single sales factor favors companies that have big operations and few sales. What is that other formula that California used? What would that favor?
It would favor the same kind of activity, just not to the extent that a single sales would. So keep in mind, throughout the 90s, Oregon had a double-weighted sales factor as well. So kind of the starting point was an equally weighted factor for these.
Mm-hmm.
And then states, as they tried to attract some manufacturing business or use that as an incentive, they moved to heavier weighted sales factors.
Okay. And is California talking about getting a single sales factor, or they're doing fine with the double?
I'm not aware of specific conversations. I try to keep up on the other states, but it's quite a bit to do. But a lot of the states, it does seem to be a constant topic of conversation, so I wouldn't be surprised if they were talking about it. But I can't point to a specific piece of legislation or something where they're considering it at the moment.
Of course, it's not a factor in Washington, because they don't have an income tax. They have a different system altogether. Okay. All right. Thanks.
And here's an example of changing from a double to a single sales factor, and I'll see if I can keep the winners and losers straight this time around. So we have Company A and Company B, who are largely the same. Their payroll factors are the same, property factors are the same, and the sales factors are different. Company A has a 20% sales factor, and Company B has a 50% sales factor. So under a double-weighted system, the sales factor for Company A would be 27.5, and for Company B, it would be 42.5. Then moving to a single sales factor, for Company A, their apportionment factor falls from 27.5 to 20. And for Company B, their apportionment factor actually increases from 42.5 to 50.
Mm.
So for Company A, net income of $5 million, under the double-weighted factor, the $5 million times the 27.5% means $1.375 million of income is taxed by Oregon. And under the single sales regime, the $5 million times the 20% means $1 million. So Company A would be a net winner, because they would have less income taxed by Oregon. Company B, again, $5 million. Under double sales, the 42.5% of the $5 million results in $2.125 million being taxed by Oregon. And for the single sales, 50% of the $5 million, or $2.5 million, would be taxed by Oregon. So on an individual basis, there were two-thirds of the companies were like Company B, and one-third was by Company A.
Okay, so the way Company B, if you go up to the top of the chart, you got 30% payroll, 40% property, that's 70.
Madam Chair, you can't add these up. What I was trying to do, for Company B, these are just their Oregon apportionment factors.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So it could be if, let's say, both of these operate in Oregon and California, the percentages here for California would be 70%, 60%, and 50%.
I see.
That's the way you would add them up.
Okay. Oh, okay. I see. Okay. So people with high sales got hurt by this, and people with low sales. Okay.
Exactly. You mentioned Washington. Another aspect to the tax is the throwback rule. And the attempt here, again, is to try and tax corporations at 100% of their income, not more, not less. But as we've seen in the examples I picked here, it's an imperfect science. So what we have here in this chart is a company who, again, for the most part is operating in Oregon and California, but they also have $15 million of sales in Washington. There's no nexus in Washington. So their apportionment percentages, if under this so far, would be 17% for Oregon. Again, that's their sales factor. In California, 67.5. That's a double-weighted sales factor. And then Washington, it's zero. So their total apportioned income would just be 84.5%. But because there's no nexus with Washington, these sales get thrown back to Oregon. We're talking about a company domiciled in Oregon. So those sales go to zero for Washington, they get thrown back to Oregon, and so then the Oregon sales go from $20 million to $35 million. Again, this is just for determining the apportionment percentage. And then the sales factor goes to 30%. So then the new apportionment factors are 30% for Oregon, the California is unchanged, and then 97.5% of their income gets taxed.
And they get thrown back to Oregon because they're domiciled in Oregon?
In Oregon.
Okay.
If it were a California company, they would be thrown back to California. And again, the point of all this is to try and get this to be 100%, not above or not, and not below.
I think the point is to try to get more companies to be domiciled in Oregon. Senator Morris.
Thank you. When you have disparate tax systems like Washington, their business and occupancy tax, and Oregon with an income or excise tax, how do you reconcile the apportionment of those different systems?
Well, the apportionment, Senator Morse, is just for the income tax. And so I think what you're getting at would be the notion of total tax burden on a company. And that gets to be a little more complicated, because you do have the businesses paying different kinds of tax, and the disparate systems do result in some odd results in terms of trying to apportion that. What we're talking about here is just an income tax, though.
Am I correct, Madam Chair? An Oregon company that's doing business in Washington, if they had a sales office in Washington, does the throwback rule apply for those sales that are generated in that state back to Oregon? And in that case, would there be double taxation?
If there's a sales office there, the state probably has nexus. I'll have to look up on that. I don't think so, but I need to double check that.
Okay. It just seems to me that there's a possibility. Maybe.
Yeah, it would seem to me that if you take that 97.5 and then you add Washington State on top, their tax, the business and occupation tax, on top of that, that company actually would be paying more than 100% just through a different taxing mechanism.
That's my question.
Yeah, what I was.
I think they could.
Did you have an answer?
Senator Telfer.
Thank you. It was more of a question to see if we get to the answer. Would the intent be to minimize double taxation but maximize collecting tax on, you know, at 100% or
yes,
amongst all jurisdictions?
Right.
So when you have this issue, you run the risk of some double taxation and or not collecting 100% with all three districts.
Yes,
included.
I think that risk exists both ways. But I'll dig a little
work for me, Chris.
Okay.
You've got plenty to do. There's more important than my questions.
Madam Chair,
yes,
I don't think it's the topic of this briefing today, but I think there certainly are credible sources to compare tax burdens state by state, and I know that we've had presentations on those in past sessions, and I think to the extent we're looking at policy choices, those kinds of analyses are really pretty helpful, so hopefully we'll be able to have those available to us as we move forward considering some policy choices.
Good point.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Go ahead, Chris.
Okay. Moving on to tax liability, here is a chart of the income tax rates in the various states. You can see Oregon there at 6.6%. But following up on the conversation, the questions we just had, this doesn't really get at the full liability of corporations in terms of a total business taxation concept. This really is just, these are just the income tax rates.
And how do they handle states in that chart that don't have an income tax?
They're not in the chart.
They're not in there? I thought there were more states that didn't have it. That's interesting. Okay, go ahead.
Madam Chair, I did have a question about this one, though. So do you know offhand how many of these states have the same top rate for the personal income tax and the corporate income tax?
Senator Rosenbaum, I don't know off the top of my head, but I can get that for you.
That's probably pretty easy to...
Yeah, Oregon has one of the highest top rates at 9%.
For the personal.
For the personal. So these corporations probably have higher than the personal, where I'm not sure about. You can have some other states whose top rate might be in the 7 and 8% range.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure off the top of my head about that one.
That's interesting. Delaware has 8.7, which is among the higher ones, and yet it's a haven for corporate headquarters.
Yeah, this is just a piece of the corporate tax. I always go back and forth on showing a chart like this because it is just the tax rates. There's a lot of other information that goes into determining the liability for corporations. So this is just kind of one angle of that picture.
All right, go ahead. Senator Telfer.
Thank you, Chair. But that makes an interesting comment about nexus. You know, when you start talking about somebody that's just incorporated in a state that has no presence, no office, you know, mailbox maybe, but then you really start looking at the nexus and the situs and physical presence in various states and how they get taxed. So actually, Oregon's probably one of the easiest states to incorporate in, really.
Well, I think it also, to follow up on that, it gets at the tax planning opportunities when the laws vary across the states. And a lot of work can be put into the tax planning in terms of where you headquarter and how you work the different state systems to a corporation's advantage. And there's a lot of opportunity for tax planning.
Yes, indeed. Thank you.
Here's a simple chart, the number of C-corporation returns since 1997. And we see the number has been declining over time. It's broken. I broke this into three different groups. The light blue category are the only Oregon-only corporations, and we can see that's where most of the reduction has occurred over the past 10 years. Back in 97, we were at about 27 or 28,000 Oregon-only C corporations, and then by 2006, that number's down to about 20,000. This red bar are Oregon multi-state corporations. So they're multi-state corporations headquartered in Oregon, and that number has been fairly constant over time. And then other multi-state, these are multi-state corporations headquartered in other states. And that's been fairly flat over time as well.
Madam Chair?
Senator Morris.
What does this graph show us? Go beyond the graph. What this decline is, you're trending that. It's continuing to trend down steadily.
Senator Morris, there are a lot of questions that I have, and I'm continually working on exactly what that trend means. It could get at some sort of business environment thing. It could get at the structure of businesses. Are they choosing pass-through entities as opposed to C corporations? For example, when I talk to accountants these days, startup companies generally originally form or initially form as LLCs because there's a lot of flexibility in that structure. So if they want to change, then they can do that later. If they want to change to a C corporation later, it's much easier to change from an LLC to a C corporation than to start off as a C corporation and then switch back to some other entity. So you could have mergers going on over time. You could have businesses, corporations going out of business over time. But there's still a very large question on exactly who a lot of these corporations are. For example, we'll get to some information about corporate minimum taxpayers, and two-thirds of the corporations pay the minimum tax. Most of those have very little or no income to begin with. So it's not clear in my mind exactly who all of these corporations are in terms of the business activity and the economic activity going on within the state. Just to throw out one example, homeowners associations are required to file corporation returns. So homeowners associations are in here. They are a piece of the minimum taxpayers, but they're not what I think most people think of when they're talking about corporations and the business activity in the state. So there is a little bit of a distinction between the returns themselves and the Intels and Nikes and Microsofts of the world, so to speak. So I wouldn't jump to any conclusions about that trend. I think a lot of the information gets into exactly who are these corporations that exist now and are what we're seeing just the propagation of the LLCs nowadays. So all of the new businesses aren't showing up here to begin with, or is it mergers? Those kinds of questions. I think there are still a lot of digging that I'm still working on to understand who a lot of these are and exactly what's the proper way to interpret that trend.
Thank you.
Not to disagree, but the LLC, there's no taxing. As an LLC, there is no such thing in the Internal Revenue tax system. So you either choose a C, an S, or a partnership form. And so I'm not sure I agree with that statement that they're choosing LLCs because they're going to be taxed as a C corporation or as an S corporation. There's no LLC tax return.
Right, Senator Telfer. At the federal level, the LLC, it doesn't exist.
Right.
So you have, it's a creature of the states.
No,
I'm sorry.
I understand that. What I'm saying is a C tax return, a C corporation tax return, is your and an S corporation tax return, your only options as an LLC or a partnership return. So...
Right. My understanding is that the majority, and I haven't been able to get hard numbers on this, that the majority of LLCs file as partnerships. So going back in time, and perhaps it doesn't apply from this time period here, is that before the LLCs were commonly used, a corporation, if you go back in time when that wasn't a choice, what would a given business structure as?
So basically, in effect, it amounts to going from a corporation to a partnership, and that's where the trend could be.
No, I wouldn't jump to that conclusion, no. Madam Chair.
Well, I'm talking about filing a return as a partnership if you're an LLC. In other words, the LLC is a new construct, and they used to file as a corporation, and then they become an LLC, and then they start filing as a partnership?
Madam Chair. Well, the LLCs don't exist. From the eyes of federal taxation, they have to choose what kind of entity they're going to be taxed as. So if they're choosing to be taxed as a C corporation, and I believe this is part of your point, they may very well still be in here.
Right.
If
that's the point
to the extent
trying
that,
to make,
oh, okay.
make it very
and
well.
I Was I tracking with your point?
Are you looking at me?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
No.
Okay.
But I was saying you had said that the LLC is the entity most widely chosen at this point.
Chosen.
And I disagree with that because okay. they convert to partnership law, which is the most complicated law, and so we really try not to go back to practicing partnership law anymore. So anyway, just a little...
Okay.
And then the correction that those LLCs are filing as a C, an S, or a partnership, too. So.
Okay. All right. Let's go to another chart. Good.
The corporate tax liability.
Let's go to another one. We just keep flipping until we like one.
Catch a sketch.
It'd be interesting to see what it was for 2008.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
That's right.
Okay, well, there probably isn't much left to say on this chart, but it just shows the with and without kicker liabilities for the corporations. And here is the corporate tax liability broken out among the Oregon-only, Oregon multi-state, and other multi-state corporations. So the Oregon-only corporations, fairly average, they contribute about $50 million of tax, and the Oregon multi-state are another $50 million of tax each year using very rough averages. And so a lot of the variation we're seeing comes from the other multi-states, so these are going to be the larger corporations.
So that top line, those are out-of-state multi-state corporations, that's their Oregon tax liability?
Correct. The point behind this, there's often a lot is made of Oregon companies versus multi-state companies. Mm-hmm. And so I've just provided some breakdown here. And one of the groups that seem to get lost in there is that there are Oregon multi-state companies as well. Mm-hmm. It's not just one or the other. The annual change in the liability, we can see this is just a chart that highlights the variance in that liability where it switches from losses of 30% to gains of 50%, which makes, as you know, the forecasting of the tax rather difficult.
And then maybe it's a Paul question. We've got up through 2006, and I can't remember where our last forecast would have put us on that graph. Paul, do you know?
I'm Jerry looking at the current biennium, 709. I think we're down marginally thus far. Mm-hmm. We haven't seen a big drop, but it's been negative. You know, we had what would have been a credit to go out as a kicker, but that was retained through the rainy day fund. Mm-hmm. And that was actually deposited. See, that kicker was based on our estimate of what that liability was. And then that $319 million was deposited in September. So, in effect, that was taken off the top.
Oh.
So the general fund has the risk part of it in terms of what the corporate revenue is. But if you include the $319 million in it, I think it's pretty close to breaking even with prior years.
This chart breaks down the tax liability and the number of returns by the 10 largest sectors. So the bars themselves are the number of returns. So we can see the three largest sectors there by number of returns are wholesale trade, construction, and then professional, scientific, and technical. But in terms of tax liability, it's the wholesale trade is the largest, followed by finance and insurance, and then retail trade, and then manufacturing. Those all have the lion's share of the tax liability. When we get down to information, which is the fifth largest in terms of tax liability, we get down to more or less sectors of equal size of just under $20 million. And this is the number and tax liability of C corporations by taxable income. And this it's almost self-defined in that those with the largest taxable income pay the largest tax what I'm trying to show here is just the concentration of tax among a handful of corporations. So we have very few corporations with $25 million or more taxable income, and they pay the lion's share of the tax, again, contributing to the volatility and the difficulty in forecasting it, because you get down to forecasting just a handful of corporations. And here is a similar chart, number and tax liability of C corporations by Oregon sales. And it's going to be very similar to the prior chart, where a handful of companies with large numbers of sales, Oregon sales, large income, and they pay the lion's share of the tax liability. Kind of telling the same story. This chart, I'll probably try to do too much in one chart here, but this gets at the minimum tax. So we have the number of S corporations paying the minimum tax, and the vast majority of the S corporations only pay the $10 minimum tax. The number of C corporations paying the minimum tax is roughly around 20,000, but the percent paying the minimum tax increased to as high as 68-69% in 02 and 03, but then has been falling as the environment improved in 04 and 05 and 06. And in likelihood, as we get, when we start seeing 08 returns, we'll see the percent and the number going up again a little bit. The reasons for the minimum tax payment: of those corporations that are paying the minimum tax, 3/4 of them, 75%, are paying the minimum tax because they have little or no income in that tax year. 23% of them pay the minimum due to losses carried forward, so they may have gains in the current year, and so in this case 2006, but they had losses from prior years to offset those. And only about 1% of the corporations paying the minimum tax are doing so solely because of tax credits that they are able to claim. And then that last 0.1%, it's a combination of credits and either losses, for the most part credits and losses carried forward, that reduced their liability in 2006.
Chair?
Senator Morris.
I think this would be a good point to ask the question. The perception in Oregon is that corporations get a free ride because they pay $10, so therefore it's a free ride. How do you justify a huge increase in the minimum tax in a corporation that does not have taxable income?
Senator Morse, I believe that's a philosophical argument about the tax.
Well, I mean, you on the spot.
Senator Morse, I'm
kind of
going
a rhetorical question,
I'm
I guess.
I'm going to jump to the defense of my staff, and I'm going to throw the answer back to you.
Well, you know, Madam Chair, it is a very legitimate discussion. If you have businesses that are in distress and have no taxable income, and you have to go back, and people have to go back and look at your, you know, gross receipts and then your cost of goods sold and go through all those calculations, and if the expenses are greater than the revenues, then you have either a loss or no profit.
I think what contributed to this issue was that were the years when Portland General Electric paid $10 in tax while collecting millions from taxpayers for payment of taxes that was consumed by Enron through their tax planning or manipulation.
And it poisoned the well with a very small group, poisoned the well for a lot of businesses that draw from that well. We'll have this discussion, I'm sure, in the future.
We'll have this discussion because it's really there's a difference between a distressed company and a company that has done a very good job of tax planning, especially multi-state companies that would not be in the same category as a truly distressed company.
You can have a company that has no taxable income, that's a C Corp, that chooses to increase salaries to offset that tax and take it out as personal income, but the corporation actually is paying then a 9% raise opposed to 6.6%. Senator Telfer, you probably see more of this, but the fact that the assumption is that they don't pay for Oregon's welfare and I would challenge that.
Yeah, and your response, when it says minimum tax, there are lots of corporations who are paying $10 as what we call minimum tax, but the tax on the profits of that corporation are huge because they're being paid at 9% at the individual level. So, you know, it's you got to understand what you're talking about on minimum tax as a corporation. A pass-through corporation pays more tax, but they pay it at the shareholder level, not the corporate level. So, I think if we have this, and we will have this discussion in the future, we have to be very clear on what we're talking about.
That's correct, and that's one factor. But the other factor is that the minimum tax was put into law in the 30s at the $10 level, and it has stayed at the $10 level since the 30s. And so that's another way of looking at it. It's one of a number of things we have in our statutes that have not been escalated with the cost of living over the years.
The question I would have then is if, like Senator Morris is saying, if a company's not making money, why are we increasing a tax on them? I mean, if they have zero taxable income, why would we increase it? If I had zero taxable income on my personal tax return, I wouldn't want to pay a tax.
Well, they did it in the 30s, and they seem to have...
We stayed in the Depression until the days
before as corporations, yeah. And, you know, it's a different
sure.
world.
Madam Chair, I just want the record to reflect that I'm exercising great self-control by not joining this discussion. I did actually have one question for Chris, though, and I had wanted to ask it. We listened to the tax compliance report the other day, and I unfortunately had to leave, and I know some members weren't able to come at all, and it appeared that there were a relatively small number of corporate taxpayers from whom a great deal of money was reaped by auditing those returns, and I wasn't able to be there for that portion of the presentation, but is there anything in this presentation today, Chris, that pertains to compliance issues, or was that just something completely different from what we're looking at here?
Senator Rosenbaum, I don't have anything in here on compliance, so those were separate. I guess I was thinking that compliance presentation would touch on that, so I didn't include anything specific on compliance.
Senator Rosenbaum, the compliance study, the detailed study that was presented in the second half of the meeting, that pertained only to personal income taxpayers.
Oh,
so
I see.
So that was focused on that, and that decision was made really last February, so we could focus on that and try to begin with that to get a sense of what all those issues were, the behavioral issues around that. But the corporate, I'm sure. Deborah would attest to this, is a whole different compliance issue because you're dealing with a lot more sophisticated taxpayers in many cases. So that we did have in the last session, as you recall, a voluntary compliance initiative administrative program that the department was authorized to conduct, and maybe we can take a closer look at that at a later time because that may give us a feel for what we learned from that.
And Madam Chair, just to comment, I think, although we don't want to take time for that whole presentation, it just seems like it would be interesting to look at that because if there are areas of the tax code where we're having a high rate of non-compliance, those might be areas that we might want to take a harder look at. That kind of goes without saying that we've created some incentive for non-compliant behavior, I guess, just to keep saying the same thing. So,
the Willie Sutton theory. I'll get it right this time.
Yeah, exactly.
Go ahead, Chris.
In the next section here are a few slides on tax credits taken by corporations. And here we have from 1996 to 2006 the amount of credits used. And we can see that the amount of credits tends to increase in the boom years because the corporations are going to have more liability and then they're able to use more of the credits that they have on their books. And since 2001, 2002, since that recession, we've been on a steady incline in the amount of the credits used. Again, this is all just through 2006. It's the most recent data available from the Department of Revenue.
Boy, and that's a Betsy tax credit, mm-hmm. even through 2006. My goodness.
Sure.
Senator Hess.
Well, I was going to say this is in part an answer perhaps to Senator Morris's question that I know specifically with Enron, while we were looking at that, is one of the reasons they got to that minimum tax was because they had so many write-offs and deductions and pollution control tax credit that, you know, by the time they exhausted all those, decommissioning of their Trojan nuclear plant, that, yeah, they got up to the place where they were no longer liable for a taxable income at that point. But that was millions of dollars in taxes that they were sort of forgiven for because of these credits. It's still okay to beat up on Enron, isn't it? Okay.
Yeah, it's okay to beat up on Enron.
Not PGE, though.
That's an Oregon company. Senator Telfer.
Thank you. The point of clarification, these credits are Oregon credits that we're talking about here.
Correct, Senator Telfer.
Okay, and the Oregon credits are an incentive that are voted on to
correct.
Spark something, some activity, some behavior. So there's nothing negative necessarily about a company taking advantage of the Oregon credits that they've been given to enable some sort of behavior or some sort of action.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. But in the case of the pollution control credits, they have been repealed because it was concluded that they were not producing any benefit. So we have 20% of this chart credits that have since been judged to not be productive.
20% saying they're not productive.
Not productive for the taxpayers. That's why they were repealed. I worked on that for 10 years, Senator Telfer. Okay. Go ahead, Chris.
Okay. And here's a chart just showing breaking down credits on a percentage basis between the amount used and unused. And so historically, only about 40% of the credits claimed in any of these years actually get used, and so 60% remain unused and carried forward to the extent that they can, depending on the credit. So while, for example, in 2006, the amount of credits was $60 million, there were $93 million that were not used in 2006 that are still on, were most likely still on corporations' books to be used in 07 and 08. So along with the incline, the increase in used credits from $26 million to $60 million, the unused also doubled from $45 million to $93 million between 03 and 06.
Okay, I think that chart is missing from our handout.
That one?
Oh, no, never mind. It was just out of order. Okay, I got it.
Here's a breakdown for 2006 for the amount of credits used, and we can see that 40% of those credits are the business energy, the BETSI credits. Pollution control is still significant at 20% in 2006, and then qualified research is next at 13%. And here is a chart showing some trends in the use of the major credits, just a four-year trend, and with BETSI being the most prominent here, the change there beginning in 2005, we can see the amount of BETSI credits used increased from 7 or 8 million in 03 and 04 to 20 million in 05 and 06. So even before the implementation of the changes in 07, the use of BETSI was growing dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
As the chair mentioned, pollution control credit sunset in 2007, so eventually the amount of these credits, barring any other legislative action, will eventually start to go down, but there is a 10-year carry forward there, so it'll be a while. And then the research credits, I point out, here they're still substantial. There were recent changes in, I believe, 05 that expanded the amount of the research credits that could be claimed. And then the remaining, the dependent care and farm worker housing, are relatively small. In terms of unused credits, you can see that the major player there, as of 2006, were the research credits. So $40 million in the research credits were unused in 2006.
Why is that, Chris? Why was that so high?
Well, there was an increase in 2005, I believe, that increased the cap from $750,000 to $2 million. So individual corporations could now claim a lot more, but their liability simply, I guess the easiest way to think about it is they can use, they're eligible for a lot more credits, but their tax liability did not go up correspondingly, so they just have more unused credits on their books.
Thank you, Chair.
Senator Hess.
And if I remember correctly, Paul, correct me, that one thing about the research credits is it is tied to jobs and positions in Oregon, employment positions.
Yes. Senator Hess, I mean, it is one of, I'm sure partly due to one of the consequences of going to a sales factor, because those firms that are getting the R&D credits have had their liability reduced because they do have a lot of property and payroll in the state. So I think there is that interaction there. It may be one reason why we're seeing less of those credits being used.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, if you just look at the industry, you look at how there's been a shift in industry mix of corporate taxpayers. And Chris showed you the latest, but I mean, we've seen an emergence of, wholesale trade, retail trade, financial services. Those have become our biggest taxpaying industries, but they're not ones that use a lot of R&D credits, because those are the ones that have the property and payroll.
And one of the other things to point out here is the growth in the Betsy unused credits in 2006. From 2005, it was $8 million, and then by 2006, it was $25
million. And Madam Chair, just a quick question.
Senator Rosenbaum.
Does the unused credit bar then include credits that could have been sold to other companies, but there's no market for them too? I mean, I guess I'm not totally clear on what it means when they're unused. Just nobody is availing themselves of these credits, either by selling them or using them.
No, Senator Rosenbaum, these are the credits that are reported on their tax return. So I think what you're getting or alluding to are the pass-through program for it, especially Betsy, where they're somebody is eligible for a credit and they have it, but they want to sell it. A lot of those entities they don't even incur a tax liability. They're not corporations. They might be nonprofits, or they might be school districts where they're eligible for the credit, but they want to sell it. This is not those. This is just the amount that appears on the tax return. So it'll be Corporation A who has $10 million in credits that they claim, and they're trying to use them on their tax return.
Okay, so if they buy a credit from the school district, does that show up on theirs?
Yes. Yes. Okay. If they've purchased it and reported on their tax return, but what's not there are any unpurchased credits that are out there. Is that
so? The school district wouldn't report it on theirs because they're not a corporation. So there are some credits out there that are not reflected.
Right. The universe here is just what shows up on the tax return.
Okay.
These are corporations who are trying to use credits.
Who either got the credit themselves through some energy efficient thing that they did, or they bought the credit.
Betsy, yes.
And either way, they show up there. Now, when they buy the credit, they buy the credit at a discount. So that, I presume, it's the discounted value that shows up here.
No, it's the full amount. I mean, when they buy the credit, they'll pay kind of a present value for it. So if I sell a corporation the credits, they'll pay me the discounted value. They're entitled to that full credit, and that will show up.
Okay. All right.
Okay, the last piece here are tax collections. And again, this is the revenue stream side of things. And you'll recognize this slide. It's very similar to the liability. It's just for the fiscal year collections. And the annual change here, very similar to the liability. Again, we can have collections falling from 40% or gaining 40% on an annual basis year over year.
Mm-hmm.
And here's a chart. Each month, the Department of Revenue puts out some sector charts. And they break down the corporate tax collections by sector, and it's on a 12-month moving average basis. So the latest version, or at least when I created this, they had their charts through November 2008. So it's for the 12 months collections through November 2008. And so it shows a couple of things. One, this is something you see, a third of the tax collections are due to the wholesale trade sector, as we've mentioned, with the next largest being finance and insurance, retail trade, and then manufacturing is still significant. So here we have on the red bars are the number of taxpayers, and then the black bars are the amount of tax. And here I have four charts for individual sectors, and pardon the size here, but I just wanted to put four of them on the chart on the one slide just to get a sense of how the trends vary depending on which sector you're looking at. So for the wholesale trade sector, the tax collections have increased for a while, then they dipped, and then they increased again through the early part of 08, and then they're starting to level off. And again, this is a third of the state tax collections now for C corporations. Retail trade was pretty flat through most of the time here at $40 million. They peaked at about $60 million, and then they dipped and recovered, and they dipped again. Manufacturing is all over the place. It's continually up and down. And then the finance and insurance, we had a nice drive up here, but for the most part, it's been declining ever since. And this is information that we look at and the state economist looks at to get a sense for which direction collections are going. This table here is another way to highlight that the wholesale trade, again, for fiscal year 08, was about a third of the tax collections, and then retail, manufacturing, and finance and insurance are here, all at about 13%. This is just another way of describing the volatility. So, for example, in the manufacturing sector, for each of the fiscal years from 04 through 08, we have the percentage changes where in 04 they increased 379% and then fell 65% and increased 149% and fell 47%. Again, contributing to the volatility. That's going with the single sales factor. It's moving some of the concentration from the manufacturing sector to the wholesale trade sector. But here, recently, we still have some large changes. And again, the 78% here, that's when the single sales factor kicked in July 1, 2005. So some of that increase is due to the single sales factor. The last two slides I have here are a time series of collections for a tax year. What this is, beginning January 2006 through November 2008, so for 3 years here, we have the collections for tax year 2006 for the corporations, whereas, so for this part here, these are all the estimated payments they make, and then when they start filing returns and then getting refunds. And generally, after 3 years, we have 100% of collections for a corporation. I mean, the collections actually continue on out due to audits and those kinds of activities, but after 3 years, we have a rough sense of what the collections will be, but that's very much after the fact in terms of forecasting purposes. And generally, after 2 years, we have about 110% of the collections on an average year. At the end of the second year, we'll refund, for the most part, 10% of those collections during that third year. And so part of this is just to provide a picture of the trend of those collections, but it's also to show for tax year 2008, we are 1 year into those collections, and so we have each of the quarterly estimated payments, which are the spikes, but the rest of this is unknown, and this is what we'll be watching over the rest of the year to see what kind of payments come in and refunds go out. But it will be another 2 years before we have a solid handle on what 2008 looks like.
So what happened in October of 07 to depress collections in that period?
Well, the trend, the shape of this is pretty typical for corporations. The penalties for underpayment from corporations are pretty stiff. So corporations tend to overpay. They want to avoid those penalties. So as they make their estimated payments, and even when they file their tax return, or file the payments for their tax returns, because they may file an extension for the return itself, but it's not an extension for the liability, they will tend to err on the side of overpaying. So generally what we see is this pattern where when those returns are eventually filed, refunds go out.
Oh, okay, so that's refunds.
And yeah, that's generally, the shape is fairly typical.
Okay.
And that was it.
Okay, questions? Boy, this is a good presentation. There's a lot of material in here. Thank you for making order out of very complex material. Any questions from the committee? Okay. Thanks a lot, Chris. Any other business before the committee? Senator Morris.
Just if I might, a quick question. Is there any way to track the dollars that are reinvested
back into these corporations. And let me put it in context. People think that corporations are very wealthy and that the beneficiaries are the owners, and you know, if they walk off with loads of money. Okay. Is there any way to understand what the reinvestment is back into plant, machinery, property, expansion, jobs, in the aggregate total versus the amount of money that is declared through dividends? Do you know of any database that tracks or has the capacity to track any of that information?
I might defer to Paul on this one, but I'm not aware of a lot of detailed information on a company basis.
Aggregate total in terms of if you take the cash flow of a corporation, which is your non-cash charges plus your net after-tax income, that's the free cash flow that comes out. I may not be using the right terms, Senator Telfer, but that's my business vernacular. You know, where that money then goes.
Well, Senator, I guess I would think of it, you know, if you think about the return, and we've looked at this, we've looked at things like a value-added tax, and you have your gross receipts, and then you have, you know, what to a business are the costs. Mm-hmm. But that's really what's going back into the business. So you could look at the labor costs, which would basically be wages and salaries, and you could look at the cost of capital, which would be depreciation and interest payments, would give you a sense of how much they spend on labor and capital. And that would give you some reflection of that. We could look at those proportions that are in Oregon, for example.
Yeah, we can look at that on the tax returns. We can get aggregate information for that reinvestment into the company. You'll have the Oregon versus the multi-state, and again, we're talking about information that is largely on the federal return, so it's not always clear on how much of that is in Oregon, per se. But there's probably some information we can glean from there. And now exactly how that translates into jobs, something might need to be done on an individual company basis, having a lot more information than is available just on the tax return.
See, my understanding of the business world is that vast majority of cash flow goes back into the business to create opportunities for the owners, which means employment and a growing economy. And if that's the case, then we need to do all we can to increase that. Mm-hmm. Because that's the engine that makes all of us happy.
We're going to have some very interesting proposals to do that, too. Stay tuned.
I was just going to respond on that. A possible, because it's a function of working capital. That's your cash flow and how it's changing. I suppose the census may grab some of that. I don't think an income tax grabs that. A financial statement does, statement of cash flows. But the finance industry might have that record. Economic development organizations might garner that. But I can't see where on a tax return it would be reflected.
People who are applying for the Betsy tax credit have that.
See, if you look at the, Madam Chair, if you look at the 6.5% that we collect, of course, the feds collect a whole lot more. You know, the effective tax rate is probably closer to 45%. What happens to the other monies that have not been taxed, that are left over after tax, and then add back into your non-cash charges? So that's your cash that's available. My guess is if there's any way to measure that we would quickly realize that money is reinvested. It's not put into yachts and airplanes and, you know, stuff like that. It's reinvested back into the business.
Madam Chair, it seems like though some of this is really sort of a proprietary information issue, because it's very easy to assert that you're doing that, but since a lot of this information really is proprietary,
You can't really look at individual corporations and see how much tax they're paying, except as an aggregate, or what they're doing with the taxes foregone. And so unless somebody wants to change that, you know, and say, we want, when we used to have corporations like Intel that I think held press conferences and said, we're paying this much in income tax, and this is what we're doing for the state. And then a few years ago, they stopped doing that. I don't know why they made a business decision to not voluntarily tell us how much they were paying, but they did. And so then it becomes sort of trying to look at things like the tax incidence model and see how well, as an aggregate, we're getting the behaviors that we predicted from various changes. But you're right, this is going to be an interesting few months.
Yes, it is. Okay, we are adjourned.